going to be chaired by Robert French, the Secretary of the Pride History Group. And I might say, I think we've got copies of everyone's biographies that were out the front, so there's more detail on the biography side of things.
When we actually started to talk about this conference about 18 months ago, one of the things that we're actually very keen on is the fact that it really be a national conference. And it's no coincidence that the largest session at this conference is in fact the one this afternoon with the speakers from interstate. But nonetheless, Sydney and Melbourne obviously become the focus right at the beginning. All the speakers this morning have been given a brief that they need to just talk about their life in camp, at least on this particular panel, how they joined, how they heard about it, life in camp, relationships possibly with gay liberation, to the extent to which they thought they were part of a national movement, comes a bit later on. I mean, there was in Adelaide in 1973, there was a national camp conference. To what extent later on were the panellists more involved with the liberation? Again, the way they felt they were part of a national movement. How did they work together? Gay Pride Week was in fact a joint camp, gay liberation venture. So these are some of the things that we actually wanted to explore. But I just thought also that what we should do is in fact just bring out an icon and honour the person that actually made this. So I just thought, even though I look like I'm batting for the other side by putting it on, Sydney Gay Liberation. It actually belonged to Dave McDiamond of happy memory, and he bequeathed it to John Lee, and John Lee of happy memory bequeathed it to me. We're going to start the speakers this morning from this end onwards. I'm not going to go via the program as they're speaking, and the first will be Peter Bonsall-Byrne.
Why don't I turn the microphone?
Good morning.
Cross Section was established very soon after the beginning of Camp New South Wales. From the beginning, it met at our house at 16 Terry Street in Balmain. Meetings opened with prayer. Just how 70s is this? But we knew the Salvation Army members' contributions would always be much longer than those of the Catholics. They were always short and sweet, and then they would disconcert us non-Catholics by ending with Amen instead of Amen. Cross Section's brief was to encourage those members of camp for whom religious worship was important, to speak out about their homosexuality within their existing congregations, to come out in church. Each week, members would talk about their success or failure in doing this. And we also had visiting speakers of various backgrounds. Arthur North, the convener of the Church of Nation Committee of the Presbyterian Church, spoke to us. George Coghlan, who was the founder of the Marriage Guidance Council in New South Wales, and Father Austin Day, then Rector of Christ Church St Lawrence in Sydney. At the Sydney Anglican Synod of October 1973, a devastatingly awful report on homosexuality was adopted. I was a member of Synod at the time and spoke vociferously against accepting the report. One clergyman in Synod offered half-hearted support to my stand. But of course, acceptance of the report was absolutely guaranteed. The attitude of the Anglican Church in Sydney, of course, has deteriorated since then, if anything. Some members of Cross Section sprang into action and produced a retort to the report distributed to all Sydney Anglican clergy. One ferocious respondent, H.C. Dunstan from St. Barnabas Mill Hill, which church is now deconsecrated and converted to units in a predominantly gay area of Sydney. And H.C. Dunstan, I know you're glad I'm not going to read this whole book, H.C. Dunstan wrote to us, "What sick report you sent me to read. How plausible is the argument of those who indulge in what they know to be evil, looking desperately for some backing to support them. An acceptance of the Holy Bible as absolute truth does not allow me now, nor ever will, to call evil good or vice versa." That sentence is a bit convoluted, isn't it? That followed by a rubber stamp impression, which read, "God is not dead, there is a living God, he has spoken in the Bible, he means what he says, and will do as he promised." There's not really much more. Maybe you have read the clear statement on homosexuality broadcast by the Reverend Canon D.B. Knox. If not, the enclosed is a copy of his statement as printed in my parish paper of May 1973. I agree with all that he said. Homosexuality, drunkenness, drug addiction, etc., etc., can be adequately dealt with, and the individual completely rehabilitated God's way by confessing the sin, by repenting and belief in the Christian gospel, by invitation to Jesus Christ, who is Almighty God, I think that might be theologically suspect, to dwell in the individual's heart by faith and using grace by which to obey God. Remember, God will never allow anything to enter a human life that is more than a person can cope with. See 1 Corinthians, etc. The Western Church definitely condemns the sin of sodomy by whitewashing it. It's called homosexuality. But as its Lord loves the sinner and must always extend a helping hand, the cure is God's, by God's methods, for anyone to do things through Christ who strengthens him. Philippians, etc. Another rubber stamp. Jesus Christ is our only hope. No reply is needed to this. For I thank God that I am a Christian by the grace of God, believe Christ is adequate for all my needs, universal panacea misspelt, and his word is absolute truth. This is not brainwashing by the Sydney Diocese, but an acknowledgement of just plain common sense and decency. Oh. And refusal to change my convictions on the pleas of a half dozen sick individuals who, because they can't get what they want, not only leave the church, but abuse its stand. H.C. Dunstan, St. Barnabas Mill Hill, Waverley. I was also going to bring just another of our panellists writes in the book Being Different. Scene 2, the end of 1972, probably later in October or early November, a Monday around 7 p.m. I stand outside a two-storey terrace house with olive green facade in Terry Street, Balmain, overlooking Iron Cove on the inner outskirts of central Sydney, New South Wales. After some three quarters of an hour walking up and down the street and wondering if I should go in, I climbed up the few stairs and knocked on the door. A man in his mid-30s opened it. He recognised my voice from an earlier call and showed me inside, where I was introduced to other men. Around 8 p.m. that evening, cross-section, a group of Christian homosexuals hell-bent, pun intended, on changing the attitude of their churches to homosexuality, would meet. The priests and ministers would be invited to attend its meetings. Some, possibly themselves homosexual, would take up the challenge, only to discover, as I had that evening, that there was nothing queer about us. Joseph Chepkuti's words. As an organist, I did mention Angays, where most of us worshipped at St. Luke's, Enmore. I was the organist at the time, but I feel that I can, and the Reverend Mother Inferior, who gave us such a wonderful blessing this morning, was a major member of the choir. But because of the Diocese of Sydney, as an organist, I can no longer support the Anglicanism of the diocese, and I will, they will no longer hear my fingers tickling the ivories, unless any of you would like specially gay and wonderful music for your forthcoming marriage. Thank you.
Get Bon and Lynn to actually just swap so we've got the right to go. And while they're doing that, Bon made mention of the Reverend Austin Day at Christ Church St Lawrence. And in camp circles, most appropriate for a clergyman, he was known as Agnes Day. I should also remind people that it's Bon and Peter Duval, who were really instrumental in the setting up of the Phone a Friend service and the counselling service. I think at one stage it was actually in their front room before it moved to 33A upstairs. Lynn Thomas.
Hi. My journey through to camp, probably less political than most. I started in the late 60s as a born-again Christian in the Pentecostal church, and where they prayed for me to remove the spirit of lesbianism, which I'm pleased to say didn't work. But that put the whole concept, I guess, into my head. Because I remember standing there with these people around me praying, and I'm thinking, spirit of lesbianism, okay. Because, there was no information around at that time. You know, it's not like today where you see it on TV or it's in novels and stuff. It was not accessible, I had no idea. So I had social justice issues, though. I'd grown up in a very working class family and with a lot of violence and so on. And through that sort of avenue, through the church and so on, I became very aware of issues like the Vietnam War. I was the only person in my high school who struck on the Students' Activist Day in, I think it was May 1968, nobody noticed. But I started going to demos for against Vietnam War and so on, and for the peace marches. And then one day I was looking through a newspaper and there was this two-page spread on these gay dances or homosexual dances that were being held in Paddington Town Hall. And they had, pictures of, two guys and two women and people walking upstairs, and they had all the black things going across. And I think that was the law in those days, that they had to hide their identity. And So I had some friends who, we'd all sort of danced around the issue and so on, and we talked about it, I guess. I don't really remember, but we ended up at this dance, and that was how I came into camp, because camp ran these dances. Around that time as well, though, I'd been thinking about, what it means to be a lesbian, what it meant to be homosexual, what it meant to be a woman in the world, and I'd gone to the Mitchell Library to get information on lesbianism, because you couldn't get it, I had to fill out a form, lie, say I was a student. I had no concept of university, so I wasn't a student really, I just told them I was a student, to get these books out. And I got the book out, and I think Lex mentioned it, and it was West's book on homosexuality. And, lesbians had moustaches and hairy legs and criminal tendencies. And I can see relate. It was true. So I've got this image, and I've got these scripts being removed from it and all this sort of stuff about this time. So it was all very confusing for me. Coming from a very working class background where, my father was probably the only person in Australia who was unemployed in the 60s. Yes, and housing commissions. So I was very overwhelmed at the time. And coming into camp, I'd grown up with a lot of violent men in my life. And it was the first place I actually met gentle men. And that was a big thing for me. I was very aware of the separatist movement, and I actually understood the dynamic about needing space. But I never wanted to separate from healthy men. To me, it was all very important to have that integration. I don't remember very much about gay liberation. It was all political. I think it was Jermaine Greer who said the personal is political. Somebody said it. And it was, you walked around the street holding hands with your girlfriend. That was a personal statement, but it was actually political as well. And you know, you just did it. I remember doing it, and I remember people sort of, you know, I've been spat upon, and a guy jumped out of a bus once and tried to drag me away from my That was a bit bizarre. A lot of it was bizarre. And, you know, people were very open in their hostility back then, and, it's, you know, it was... So I guess I was more part of the critical mass that just sort of lived their lives and walked through, you know, walked through Sydney, holding hands.
I don't know how much more I've got.
No, you can stop there.
Yeah, I think that's about it. So, you know, probably some other stuff will come up later if I think of it, but, yeah.
Now I've got Charlie Bowers, who was involved right from the almost the very start, weren't you, Charlie? Yeah.
Yes, pretty well, certainly in 1970. My first contact with CAMP was I actually was working at the Anchor Bookshop. Some people might remember John Brink, and famous and wonderful character in Sydney back in the 60s and 70s. He came out from South Africa and was leader of the anti-apartheid movement in Australia, but it also became sort of a centre for all sorts of radical people. And he introduced me to Michael Cass, who was then, as Lex mentioned, working at New South Wales Uni. And Michael invited me down to his and John's flat at Kirribilli towards about September, I think it was, or mid-70. And I went and visited them a couple of times, and Christabel Pohl had a flat nearby in the same block. And it was there that we talked about forming an organisation, CAMP. And I was my memory is a little bit vague, but I was there the night that they decided that
You're the anachronism, Charlie.
Campaign for moral persecution. I claim
against.
And anyway, my next memories are of the wonderful Balmain clubhouse, and which was a lot of fun. And I think I was attracted to it more for the social life than the actual political side of it, and I have wonderful memories of barbecues in the backyard and great big crowds. We got a membership very quickly within that first year or so of up to 700, I think it was. And it was funny, somebody did a survey of the professions of the 700, and 80% they claimed were teachers. But that's true or not, probably a fair percentage of them were. And by word of mouth, the word spread. And I can remember wonderful barbecues, and the firemen next door were always very interested in our barbecues, and very quickly climbed over the fence. And I think it was a free beer was the most. And that was a lot of fun. But I can remember the beginnings of tension building up there with Gay Lib and CAMP and in front of the fire in the winter there. The following year there were talks about splits, and then of course Dennis took his group away and opened up down in Blue Point Road. And another memory I have there is it was the first time really, apart from meeting Christabel in the house, that I had any sort of meeting, any sort of social contact with open lesbian women. And that was interesting. I remember one particular couple there, and somebody might remember them. Luckily I don't remember their names. They were wardresses, or whatever you call them.
Prison officers
at the women's prison at Silverwater. And they want, one of my previous lives, it was a clergyman, and they wanted me to marry them. I was rather shocked with this concept, and we didn't go through with that. One more minute. Okay, and what else did I say? I got here. Yes, I think that's about all. Just one thing that Lex mentioned was the, I was away overseas for most of the 70s, but then I became involved with Lex and Craig with the homosexual law reform, and I ended up working for Jack Ferguson and was involved in those first the bills that didn't go through. But that was all very important, and Lex played a very important role in that. Thank you.
The parties at Balmain were indeed famous. And I think, was it Frank Morehouse, or one of the journalists who visited and wrote up the parties? Yes. And it was entitled, "The Night the Fireman Called Me Sweetie." Yes. Peter DeMilko.
I want to go back even further. This is nearly embarrassing, how far back I can go. In New South Wales, up until 1963, we had the 6 o'clock closing law for all licensed venues. This meant that as most people worked until 5:30 in the evening, you had 30 minutes to get to the nearest pub after work. Because at 6:10, you would be physically ejected from that building. It meant that in the 25 minutes or so that you were at the bar, you drank far too much, far too quickly. And that's where the Technicolor Chuck phrase came in later. It was depressing on Town Hall Railway Station to say the number of seriously inebriated men going home because they'd had a few drinks after work. So we changed that law. And suddenly, there were more gay venues. Because previous to that, the only one I ever found for drinking was the Sportsman's Bar at the Australia Hotel. There were 5 semicircular bars, each with their own barmaid. And right down the very end of this room was the gay one. All respectably dressed, all with our hats. Everybody wore hats in those days. And if they liked the look of you, they'd even talk to you. And if they didn't like the look of you, you got frozen out. And if they thought you were worthwhile even knowing, in any sense of that word, you might get invited to a dinner party on Saturday night. Or even better, the Shemalians had a dance, and you'd find out about this. Now, these were balls. They weren't dancers. You got dressed in tails, dinner clothes, the best drag I have ever seen, I think. Beautifully done. Lovely evenings. However, we changed the drinking laws, and suddenly we had places like Ivy's, and we had Enzo's, and all these other nice, warm, friendly places where you could meet gay men. But there was still no sense of identity. I was still convinced I was probably the only gay male in the whole of Sydney. My father's solution to sex education was to give me the written works of Rabelais.
Did you ever try wiping your bum on a swan's neck?
Now you mention it, no. So, one of the men that I'd met at Enzo's, and whom I knew vaguely, and who lived somewhere near me at Milton's Point, said to me at Enzo's one evening, what you doing next week? And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I think there's a meeting on somewhere in Milton's Point. You might find it interesting. I can't make it, but you might find it. It's in this unit. So I made a little note on the back of my cigarette packet, as one did, and thought, I might go to that. And that's where I discovered that there was a movement starting up. Because that was the very first session which Charlie mentioned. And I was totally bemused. I didn't know who any of these women and men were. I hadn't seen them around anywhere. They didn't seem to be part of my drinking group. And they're certainly none of them were busy on the beach that I was. And we decided, thanks to the Anglican Church, to have a meeting in Birch Grove, or East Balmain. And that's where it all started. And I think that it was a wonderful example of how networks can really work if you put your little minds to them. Particularly, as has already been pointed out a couple of times, everything we did as males was illegal. Even talking about it was probably illegal, because that might be seen to be encouraging or soliciting or something. If you ran somebody down in a motor car before the change in the Crimes Act, you might get 10 years penal servitude if you killed him. Just might. If you walked up to a man and said to him, "You're rather cute, you'd like to come back to my place for sex," you could get 15 years penal servitude. And you should never ever forget that, ladies and gentlemen. That's what the law was like. The lesbians were unbelievably fortunate in that they could only be guilty of offending the public, which meant that the police officer seeing two women holding hands might say, "And that was offensive, Your Worship," and that was the conviction. So I think those are the important things that we should remember. And because at that very first meeting we were asked to do something which was fairly courageous. It was suggested that we would like to look at some sort of social activity. We'd like to look at a newsletter, please, and homosexual law reform. And if you were interested in any of those, there was a list. You could put your name and phone number on that list. That was scary. Mm. Very scary. Mm. But homosexual law reform was the thing I thought was good. But I seem to get stuck up with Darling Street a lot. Bonsall Boone and I used to flog grog endlessly. But they were great parties, they really were. And as Charlie said, nearly 700 members by the end of the first year that we had those club rooms. Thank you.
Thanks. Yes, well, I turned 21 in 1969, so I was very much a child of the 60s, the hippie movement, and there was that incredible sense of optimism. You know, things were going to change. We were moving out of the old Australia of the 50s, the 6 o'clock closing, all that. You know, it was really going ahead. So, incredible sense I had of optimism. But that whole movement was heterosexual. And I was at university in 1970 when a rather strange straight man that I knew then gave me a copy of The Well of Loneliness of previous mention because he thought I needed to read it. Now, at this point, I probably need to point out, for those of you who don't know me, I'm actually a female-to-male transsexual. So back then, it was probably relevant to give this young, boyish, dyke-looking female a copy of The Well of Loneliness, not realising that it's probably a transgender story, but that's a whole other issue. So I read it and thought, oh shit, literally, oh shit, this is great. Now what? I did not know a single gay person, none. And as previous speakers talked, the absolute lack of any information. That particular man took me to Capriccio's, and I can't say that did a lot for me either, to be perfectly honest. And then some time I was in love with a straight woman who was at university. That didn't go anywhere either. And I met an older lesbian woman who was in a relationship. And that was all I saw of lesbian relationships, was they had come from London. The club scene there in London had probably not changed for about 40 years, you know, grill on the door, secret club rooms, and that's where gay people met. And other than that, you lived in suburbia, in complete the closet. And, you know, I mean, I said, I was a child of the 60s, you know, this did not appeal, this was not a great book. And very, I was not comfortable with that. They were older than me anyway. I think they thought I was a little, you know, and all I was young. rather impetuous and everything. They were older and, you know, and very, very closet, very conservative. I think round about in that early, very, very early 70s period, there was a Germaine Greer talk at Sydney Uni, I think. And I think that's where I first picked up literature about the movements and got involved. And I think my first demonstration was the 1972 St. Clement's one. I think I was already involved with camp to some extent by then.
Yeah.
Thanks, Peter. And certainly with the early setting up formation meetings about phone a friend and all that. Sue talked about the breakaway of the more politically radical women, and I was not politically radical. I had no feminist awareness at all when I first got involved. So I was one of the ones who stayed with camp, stayed involved with phone a friend and those sorts of activities, very much seeing social change as being through those sorts of work, and also very aware of the isolation we'd come from and the importance of something like phone a friend. I think it got kind of maybe disregarded a bit later on, but that was the only contact. It was the only way of reaching out widely. And being there and in that stage, excuse the expression, manning the phone, there was long discussions about that, and that got changed. So we staffed the phone. And those were the sorts of issues and discussions that were going on, all of that language. But it was terribly important to be there, all night shifts on that phone. Because, you know, people would be, especially young guys, maybe in country areas, late at night, get pissed, suicidal, and they'd ring us. And so, you know, I got stayed involved, but then gradually got more and more involved with the lesbian feminist and then eventually the separatist side. I can remember at an early meeting being one of the people that opposed the exclusion of men from the women's meetings, and then much later taking a very completely opposite stance. But I've got to say that there were people like Ron Austin who introduced me to feminist writers. That mix of those very much more radical people who then, some of them are like Lance Gowland and people getting involved in Gay Lib, bought that sort of outside stimulus that I've not been exposed to. It was crucial, it was a wonderful time, and I also am incredibly grateful to all of the Peters and all of the other people for those days. It may well have saved my life, I think. Thank you.
Important to remember that Phone a Friend ended up being like almost the last cell of Camp Left Standing as the others broke away. Crossways broke apart, acceptance and gays, etc. And Phone a Friend still exists today as the Gays and Lesbian Counselling Service. And Tim Errington from the Counselling Service is actually here with us today. Finally, Joseph Chikuti from Melbourne. Joseph has got a bit of analysis on the, I think, the title Camp, and that should lead us into some discussion.
I've been sort of changing the direction of my topic. So let me, I would sort of go back to that. Let me just talk something about my life before November 72, when I walked into the home of Peter Duval and Peter Bonsalbout. I was born in Malta. Malta was almost 100% Catholic. I belonged to the Society of Christian Doctrine. That was something like the Opus Dei without an overt political agenda. I always had a wish to become a Franciscan, which I eventually did. And I recall that when my father decided around 1964 to migrate to Australia, I was absolutely shocked because I thought I would become an agnostic like those Australians. But I do remember looking at a picture book of Australia and being struck by a photograph of Bondi. I must say, I wasn't really struck by the pavilion or some other aspects of the beach, but I was quite, I think I could see that my agnosticism was starting even then. In Australia, I joined the Franciscans. I was sent to Anglesey, North Wales, where I did my novitiate. I saw a number of particular friendships developing, and I was always concerned why the Catholic Church or the religious life, they got so taken up by particular friendships. But I imagine what particular friendships did is they make something overt which was really quite hidden and discreet. I then left the Franciscans and joined the rather infamous Brothers of St. Gerard. Its founder, believed to be a saint, ended up in prison. A number of other members of the society spent time in jail. We used to have prayer meetings. I never had the fortune of speaking in tongues, but I can assure you that there were other opportunities for me to develop my oral skills. The last few years, earlier this year, I returned to Malta. I launched a book which was Queer Mediterranean Memories. In that book, I claim that the founder of the Society of Christian Doctrine, George Preacher, whom Benedict recently canonized, was in fact homosexual in orientation. I had a rather prompt response by the Archbishop, the Bishop, and the Minister of Education. They all thought I was being absolutely disgusting. But this sort of brings me to one issue. When I came out, you see, while I'm an agnostic, I'm not an anti-Catholic, because, I often describe myself as a Catholic agnostic. How I was introduced to cross-section and camp is rather interesting. The founder of the Brothers of St. Gerard, who spent some time in jail, I told him I was leaving, and he referred me to a psychologist priest at St. Vincent's. And this psychologist priest, after I spoke to him and repeated that I was homosexual, and he kept asking me the question, what do you mean? He then gave me the telephone number of cross-section and said, ring them. I tried to make another appointment with him, and he said, I don't want to see you again. He said, until you go and see cross-section. He said, once you see cross-section, then come and see me. And before I left, he said, I don't think you'll be coming back to see me. And he was right, because when I walked in, I saw these people, and rather probably ignorantly, I thought all the men at cross-section, including Peter Bonsaboon, look terribly butch. and I said these are terribly normal looking people. So you know, I had this image of what homosexuals looked like, and I thought they were men who dressed up as women. And one day, waiting for a bus, the one to Balmain from York Street, I saw somebody in there who definitely looked like a homosexual. And I was absolutely frightened that this person would be walking into the same house as I would be walking into, and she was going to the same place. It was Kathy French. Some of them might know her. And she ended up some meetings later coming with Ken Birkin to buy a little room I was renting. My experience of coming out at camp was very much a personal liberation. But what I wanted to say to finish is I think one of the things that distinguished camp and gay liberation was the importance that camp gave to morality. We've got to understand that morality was a big issue in the 60s. I mean, there was Humanae Vitae at one end, and there was Honest to God on another. Very different approaches to Christianity. And we even see things like, for example, Cardinal James Freeman, who had such a hold on the Labour Party in New South Wales. And as Alex and Sue mentioned in one of the articles in Camping, the acceptance of church, the acceptance of gay men and lesbians by their churches was to some people important. Over time, of course, that importance changed, and you know, I probably have the privilege of saying that I'm probably considered one of the great anti-clericals that ever came out of the island of Malta. So you know, what I feared in 1964, you're the second one, okay. What I feared in 1964 that I would become an agnostic did in fact come through, so in some way I was even a prophet.
I often think it interesting, actually, the numbers of us who came out of monasteries and seminaries and other religious institutions. We need to actually, at some stage, try and do a census to actually see the relationship there, because there really was a very strong one in that in the early movement. Okay, I'm going to take questions now. You can put your questions to either individuals on the panel, or you can have an open question. We see who might want to answer it. I would ask that when you do ask a question, you actually just identify yourself for the record. Thank you. Julie.
I guess I'm Julie McCrossin's my name. I guess I wasn't here yesterday, so I'm just not sure if we've given due recognition to women, to men who did dress as women. Because I must say, as someone who was also hungry to find deviant and different people, was I the only one? We all seem to have walked around banging into each other, probably shops, not realising if there was another one. But, you know, to me, I've always had enormous respect for drag queens who either in their entertainment life or some in their daily life had the courage, to live life more openly. And they were crucial in Stonewall. I really was in the 70s, so I remember almost nothing until I stopped drinking in 1979. So I asked the panel, you know, where do you see the place of the drag scene, the entertainment side? And I don't mean to simply say entertainment, but those people who were confused and confusing in some ways, but who were beacons of difference and gave some of us hope.
I'd just like to say I've thought about this and how elitist we were in the group who formed camp. And we really, you know, thought of drag queens as being rather deficient, you know, subnormal. But really quite... And I can't remember one. I mean, maybe at a party there somebody turned up in drag, and I got into drag one, but very seldom. And it wasn't acceptable, really. And I don't know, that's different to the States, isn't it, to what happened in Stonewall, for instance.
Does this lead into a discussion of, say, the commercial scene, where the drag queens were, and the alternative, which Camp and the other groups are trying to establish?
Yeah. Well, I think that's true. You know, that there was a connection between the commercial scene and the drag queens. But one of the things I'm trying to look at is what campaign actually meant, what camp meant by campaign. And it's all right to look at the objectives and the aims of in the Constitution, but when you consult the camping and the newsletter, you will find, for example, different conceptions as to what the campaign should involve. One thing I was struck by was the fact that some members thought that the campaign should, amongst other things, include one of excluding the Nelly Queens from the movement because they gave us a very bad name.
Carl, do you have a comment?
Yeah, and I also think that the drag queens got it from the other direction too, with the emerging feminism of it being seen as anti-female,
a parody,
and a stereotype.
And they just copped it. They copped it both directions. And I really want to acknowledge a friend of mine who's a Koori dyke, said that it was the drag queens when the bars were busted, and she was busted off the streets when she was 14 and 15 up the cross, it was the drag queens who saved her butt over and over and over. So, you know, I think that we absolutely did them an incredible disservice at times.
Lex, I know you've got a comment here.
Just bear in mind that, and it continues to puzzle me, gay events and lesbian movement events in Sydney, it's almost obligatory to have a drag queen emceeing it, and I do not understand this.
Let's show the former empress.
Sorry,
not former empress.
Of
I only wore a drag once. Twice. Out of contact with the beard.
But picking up Julie's point, another thing you may not know under the old Offences in Public Places Act was that if you were dressed as a woman, but were not wearing any underwear, that was quite legal. But if you were wearing women's underwear, that was illegal. There were dances at the Trocadero. Every so often the constabulary would arrive and would examine men in frocks.
And I can tell you in Adelaide, actually, which is good old Protestant Adelaide, being a monk there and wandering around in black drag from, say, the monastery across to the convent, across to the hospital, that was actually considered an offence other than the fact that you were given religious status, you were actually committing offence by wearing frock in public. Brian, you had a question.
I'm Brian Nathan, Queensland. Something in response to what Julie said. As far as we know, the longest running gay bingo is the Queen's Ball in Brisbane. And that was started by a couple of terrifying to me drag queens when I was about 22, I think it was. But they've always, even though I became a rad gay liver, they were always supportive of what we did. And like I agree, I think that they were done a terrible disservice. I mean, one of the strange things that happened later on when we started the AIDS Council was the fabulous Toy to Wild, who is actually identifies as transsexual these days, I think it is, who used to be a member of Lay Girls. I mean, there were gay men at that meeting who questioned her right to be there. And, like, it was really absurd because one of the main ones was a butch guy who I used to see on the beach. And he left after two meetings and Toy was still there raising money 20 years later, you know. Exactly. Like, I just think it's bizarre that those people aren't acknowledged.
Ian, question? Yeah, sorry.
Pam Stein. On the other side of things too, remember a couple of us were in the Star Hotel up in Newcastle, which was actually a very radical gay and diversified sort of pub. We were up there doing a paper up there at the university at one stage, and we went to the Star Hotel, and a group of drag queens there, there was five of them actually, threatened to punch their lights out of it, our lights out, to get out, and they thought that we were a bunch of nuts, and nearly caused quite a big riot at the pub. So that was, they were very anti any political stance whatsoever. Didn't want to get involved in anything that forced them to come out at all. So, I mean, that's the other side of things.
Yeah.
And actually, it was, I had one of the bubbles, remember? Bubbles, God. Bubbles with fist up underneath my neck like this. And I remember somebody later on told me, you better not get up against Bubbles, because Bubbles was actually trained in boxing.
Josefa Sobsky, I'm just reflecting on Charlie's comment about attitude, the kind of judgmental attitude to drag queens. I think the same attitude amongst certain feminists pertained to butch dykes, yes, and women who dressed in male clothing and played the male role. And I know for years, and I don't think I ever went to the Clover Club for that reason, because we felt that role, this is what we were fighting, that whole thing of stereotyped roles.
Yep.
Yeah. Oh, I was just going to ask something of Sue and the panel. You mentioned in your talk recognition of relationships was something that you both lesbians and gay men in camp were interested in. What sort of format did you see that form? Did you see that taking, Sue?
I didn't. It was a letter to the editor of
Sorry.
From the early lesbians who were questioning, because it was so male-oriented, the organisation,
okay,
that this was the only thing that they could think of that they had in common,
okay,
with the male members.
All right.
And it went no further than some form of recognition.
Okay. Thank you.
Graham Willett.
Yeah, I was just kind of reflecting on the comments people were making about how we judge what was going on there. And one thing that strikes me is that we need to remember they were invented with we're inventing this from scratch. Mm-hmm. Things that now seem perfectly obvious that women should have a space of their own were not at all obvious at the time. This was an idea people came up with and had to think about why would that be true. There's a great history of women's liberation in Adelaide written shortly after the early 70s, where you can actually see them fighting that out. And that kind of disappears from the story. Yeah. And, you know, it's not as if the butch dykes like the radical dykes or the fem dykes, well, they liked the fem dykes, didn't they? But people had these kind of structured relationships that they took for granted, which suddenly came under question. and then in terms of our questioning ourselves. I think what's really interesting about this is you get a sense of just how difficult it was to make your way through that. And of course we still do it in lots of ways, but then particularly it wasn't even clear that we had to invent it. People just thought they knew what was going on. And everybody did, but they all knew very different things.
Take one more question.
Yeah. Can I just make another comment about Sydney in the 60s?
Yeah.
Nobody's mentioned the purple onion. I just find that amazing.
Yeah. 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 I mean, come to the history walk on Sunday.
It was really liberating to go to the onion on a Sunday night.
Yes.
You know, like, whee!
Personally, a very quick comment, I know it's time to finish, but I suppose one of the reasons I really wanted to come today was I'm a great believer in looking to the past for lessons to guide the future. And I was found it very refreshing that Cole admitted taking completely opposite positions. Perhaps there were one or two of us here who managed to be consistent, but most of us, if we're lucky enough to have stayed active, we've held every position under the sun. And I suppose I regret the snooty attitude that I had to some butch and femme women. I guess as I go forward in my political life now, I want to try and stay open and respectful of different attitudes and views, because I know in my own lifetime I've changed my views. I know that might sound really obvious, but you know, a lot of people are driven out of political life and activism because it's so nasty. And we've all probably ripped each other's eyes out in the past, we just can barely remember it, you know what I mean? Yeah, until we go, let's try and be more compassionate to diversity. Even though I struggled with it with the demo recently, you know, with the woman in the burqa. But I happened to have had a go on live television being asked to comment on that, and I thought, how do I deal with the extraordinary confrontation of this? And I'm sort of looking for lessons in what we are discussing here for how one deals with the tensions of today.
As I said last night, we came out into a hostile and homophobic world. And it took a great deal of bravery and courage for people to actually put their hand up and be identified. The experience of the people on the panel, and I include Ian Black in this as well, was of being the pioneers, of being the first to do it, as Graham said, inventing it as it goes along. Again, as I said last night, in ancient societies, you name it, you own it. And what they named was not equality, it was liberation. And I'd like you to actually thank these panellists who have embodied it. Break, coffee and tea out there.
We're invited to the Gay and Lesbian Counselling Service. They have an annual volunteer evening with us, some drinks and just some social gathering. Peter von Solboon and myself were amongst those who were invited to come, and we very much enjoyed it, and we were shown around the wonderful premises that the Gay and Lesbian Counselling Service has, compared to the early 70s when it started in our front room. While we were shown through the premises, I noticed that there are three telephone booths where the telephone counsellors sit and talk on the phone to people who ring in. I also noticed that there was an absence of the history, how this Gay and Lesbian Counselling Service came about. So I went home and I had some ideas, and I came up with the idea to make a plaque for each telephone booth to have it permanently displayed, so that counsellors present, when they have a spare moment, can look at those and catch up on the history. So this is a concretization of how it all happened. And I'd like to hand them over to Tim Harrington from the Gay and Lesbian Counselling Service. And he will hold them up to give you an idea of what they look like.
Thank you.
So the first one is of Krista Stahl, who came up with the idea about forming a telephone service. He had recently arrived from Sweden after Peter von Sabine and myself were on checkerboard, because Peter got the sack and there were no camp club rooms, I think, at the time. So our telephone number became the camp phone number, and we were absolutely flooded with telephone calls. Christopher Stahl had set up Phone a Friend in Stockholm, and he said, what about if we do the same here, establish a phone service where people can ring. Picture of Krista and just a story there. Now, because of the checkerboard program that Bonsall and I were on, me getting the set, I've told you that, I thought the next stage was to show the two inhabitants of the house where it started, Terry Street, Balmain. So that's us looking very gorgeous in 1972. That's the second.
They have been a bit groundbreaking.
The third one is a description of how much progress Phone a Friend had made by 1974. This is a diagram of a submission that was sent to, I think the federal, there was something like a federal health commission, the title elopes me now. But it gives an idea, the networks this small organization had already developed in a short space of time. So that's for telephone booth number three.
Introducing means it is an excellent way to commemorate 40 years of divism in New South Wales and Australia. Mm. Thank you.